This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jeremy Hobson along with Robin Young. And in a few minutes, will a strike by Sherpas shut down the climbing season at Mount Everest? But first, President Obama began his Asia trip today in Japan, meeting Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at the tiny underground sushi restaurant made famous by that 2011 documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi. But the sushi may have been overshadowed by a statement the president made before he even arrived, saying that the U.S. stands with Japan in its territorial dispute with China over some islands. President Obama said the policy of the United States is clear. The U.S. opposes unilateral attempts to undermine Japanese administration of these islands. The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes joins us from Tokyo with more on this. Rupert, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, how are President Obama's words being taken in Japan and in China, for that matter?
Well, I think they'll want to hear them again here on Japanese soil. Mm. Obviously, they're very, very welcome. And this is what the Japanese government, Japanese people were hoping for, a stronger statement of support for Japan's position over the territories in the East China Sea, and a clear statement that, America will stand up to China. So here, very happy and want to hear that again, I think, during the meetings while he's here. Already been criticized in China by the foreign ministry there. You know, predictable reactions, but important for Japan.
Well, and he's not going, President Obama is not going to China on this trip. Does this harm the U.S. relationship with China?
There is potential for China to take offense at this and feel like President Obama is coming to Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia as well, and leaving out China. But let's not forget that there has recently been a week-long trip to China by the U.S. First Lady and President Obama's daughters. And President Obama, during his two terms in office, has been to China several times. It's not like China gets ignored by the U.S. administration, although China could quite easily take offense at this.
The issue of the islands aside, what are the other items on the agenda that the Japanese are interested in hearing from President Obama about, or other countries in the region?
Well, you know, primarily it is this recommitment. I don't know whether people in the United States or elsewhere realize how special this relationship is for Japan and also for the United States. I mean, this country is the only country outside the United States that is home to a U.S. nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. It's home to 50,000 U.S. troops, to frontline fighter squadrons. Japan is very, very important to the United States, and likewise the other way around. So this recommitment, this reaffirmation of this special relationship is what Japan wants. From the American point of view, President Obama really wants to push the trade agenda. He wants to see Prime Minister Abe stick to his commitment to sign up to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to open Japan's markets to more U.S. goods, in particular to U.S. beef, rice, and other grains. At the moment, there is over 400% tariff on imports of American rice. Hmm. There is a 39% tariff on imports of U.S. beef. And the U.S. side would like to see these brought much, much lower.
Now, on this side of the Pacific, we think of the issue of the islands, the disputed islands between Japan and China that we were talking about a moment ago, as just one of many issues. But I wonder, after these statements from President Obama, is any other issue going to get through, or is that going to just dominate what comes out of President Obama's visit to Japan?
You know, I think in large part this is a very symbolic visit. I don't think we're going to see any major statements or new agreements on trade or on anything else. I think it's very important for President Obama to come here, but not just to here, to South Korea and to the Philippines as well, to state that his so-called pivot to Asia is real and that it has real substance, and that the U.S. is redeploying its forces here, its naval forces, its marine forces, to this region in order to stand by its friends. And he'll say that here, he will say it in South Korea, and in particular, he will say it in the Philippines, where U.S. troops are returning for the first time, you know, in 20 years since U.S. forces pulled out of the Philippines, that America is coming back. And this is really all in the light of the rise of China, which is causing countries around its perimeter to feel very nervous.
And of course, he'll have a lot of grieving to do in all of the countries that he's visiting, given the ferry disaster in Korea, the recent typhoon in the Philippines, the Malaysia Air Flight 370 in Malaysia, and perhaps even the Fukushima disaster in Japan.
Yeah, I think in particular his visit to South Korea on Friday is going to be difficult. South Korea is going through a very, very difficult time. There is, you know, it really is a national tragedy of a huge scale. The loss of these 250 teenagers in this boat tragedy. It's difficult to overstate just what trauma South Korea is going through at the moment. So it will be a very poignant time for him to be there. There is also the potential for North Korea to set off a nuclear device during his visit, which, right. You know, again, would set things, set the cat amongst the pigeons.
The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes joining us from Tokyo. Rupert, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Meanwhile, on Mount Everest today, dozens of Sherpas packed up their gear and walked off base camp, angry about the deaths of at least 13 colleagues in that avalanche last week and the lack of response to their demands going forward. The Nepalese government is now rushing top tourism officials to meet with Sherpas tomorrow to convince them to return. As you've no doubt been hearing, there is big money involved in climbing Everest. The government takes in millions in royalties, mountaineering companies charge people to go there, and the Sherpas make more than the average Nepalese, but a far smaller piece of the pie. The high end is about $6,000 a climbing season. That's what Adrian Bellinger pays his Sherpas. He's the founder and lead climber for Alpenglow Expeditions. They're based at Lake Tahoe, California. He's reached the summit of Everest 6 times, and he joins us by satellite phone from Everest Base Camp at the 17,500-foot mark. Adrian, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and what's it like there with the Sherpas leaving? What's the atmosphere there now?
The atmosphere is really tense and also very emotional, really across the board. The Western climbers, of course, many of the Western climbers have dedicated years of training and a lot of money to make this trip happen. And then the Sherpa themselves, is just so much emotion. There's so much sadness at the same time. There's also this really strong feeling amongst the majority of the Sherpa that the mountain should not be climbed this year, that the mountain has told them that this is not the year to climb Mount Everest. So many of the Sherpa want to leave for that reason. And then additionally, really just over the past few days, there's been this very strong reaction from certain Sherpa, certainly not all of them, but they're politically, they're using this accident to really push the Nepali government for increased wages and other changes. And that tension, that's really changing now to where some of those Sherpa are even threatening other Sherpa who would like to stay and climb with their team.
Oh, so we've been hearing, of course, about the tensions between the Sherpas and the Nepalese government, but you're saying there's tensions among the Sherpas. We've been hearing how paltry the insurance coverage, the emergency aid when someone dies, just the pay, how little it is. Some want to use this to leverage more benefits. But others, what, are they nervous about that? Do they fear they'll lose jobs?
You know, there are a lot of Sherpa working here. There might be somewhere in the vicinity of 600 Sherpa working on Mount Everest this year. You know, one thing that I think is important to know is there are quite a few Sherpa here who work especially for the legitimate Western companies whose insurance coverage is more than 2 or 3 times what the Nepali government requires and whose wages really feel quite fair to the Sherpa who work with us. So really the Sherpa's anger has been directed at what the government, the minimums that the government sets and how low they are. And there's many Sherpa here who work for less reputable companies that get only those minimums, and they're really the ones that are expressing a lot of anger.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as if one thing that needs to happen is more across-the-board requirements of the climbing companies. But meanwhile, what are you going to do? You have Sherpas who, you know, may want to work with you, but if you do let them do that and make your climb, you're going to undermine the movement of all the Sherpas.
That's right. So after spending a really emotional day in base camp today with my Sherpa, just pretty much nonstop with my team, I've made the decision we're going to cancel our expedition for 2014.
Well, what are some of the liabilities here? What happens to we understand upwards of $75,000 people can invest in a climb, and what happens to the money the Sherpas would have made?
So those are all great questions, and we're still figuring out exactly what we'll be able to refund or credit. The unfortunate thing is somewhere between 2/3 and 75% of sort of the expenses of the trip have already been incurred. We've already bought all the food, shipped it all in. most importantly, we have made a commitment to our staff, our Sherpa, our cooks, our cook boys, and also our Western staff, our expedition doctor, that we will honor the salaries that we had promised for this season. You know, everyone is so dependent on these jobs, and we don't want to jeopardize that. And we're also still hoping that the government will choose to allow the royalties or permit fees that we paid to roll over to next year, since it's really looking like it is not viable to safely climb the mountain this season.
Adrian, we are so appreciative. You're talking to us from 17,500 feet, trying to picture what it's like there at base camp. But I have to ask, you know, there are people who feel too many people have been climbing Everest. The Sherpas have been too abused by other companies for too long, that it's almost desecrating what had been a holy place, the litter that's left behind by climbers. And so why should people care about what's happening up there on Mount Everest, that maybe the climbing is being slowed down, even shut down this year?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've summited Mount Everest now 6 times, always while guiding with different groups, and there's still something incredibly powerful about this experience. And everybody who comes here, regardless of whether they're a recreational climber paying more to have support, or whether they're a Sherpa or a Western guide or a professional climber, everybody works incredibly hard to be successful here, and the outcome is always uncertain. And I think experiences like that are incredibly important to have in life. It's so special.
Adrian Ballinger, founder and lead climber for Alpenglow Expeditions out of Squaw Valley, Lake Tahoe, California, from base camp at Mount Everest. Adrian, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, it's also the income for so many people who live there. Right now, there are 31 permits for other expeditions, over 300 Westerners at base camp, waiting to see what they do. But the Sherpas say Mount Everest is home to their gods and is telling them not to climb. We'll continue to follow this story. Kenyan author Binyavanga Wainana's 2011 book about growing up in Kenya, One Day I Will Write About This Place, is called one of the best about Africa ever. One reviewer called it a stand-up-and-cheer coming-of-age memoir. But this coming-of-age memoir was missing his coming out, a chapter that he published just this year at the age of 43. It is a love letter to his mother, who died, and the words he'd wished he'd said to her, "I am a homosexual, Mom." In those words, Binyavanga also told the world, at a time when there are laws against homosexuality in African countries like Nigeria and Uganda, just being homosexual can be fatal. Well, Kenyan writer and journalist Binyavanga Wainana has lived around the world. He was writer-in-residence at Union College in Schenectady, New York, but he's recently returned to Nairobi, where he grew up, and where we reached him on Skype to ask him about the lost chapter, the title of his coming-out piece. Binyavanga, welcome.
Thank you.
What propelled that writing?
Oh, gosh. Many things. I decided to come out, and I didn't like what I was writing at all. So about 2 a.m, I just started to see it. So, of course, it was exciting to write.
Well, it's a conversation with your mother, but what else did you want to tell people about not being able to come out?
Well, I wrote this thing partly because I came back, and it's not that I'd been away, but I'd been, I guess I call it bipolar for a long time, and I got tired of it. And there's a certain way that being a fairly well-known international guy with reasonably decent income, we can travel anywhere in the world, insulated me from the costs of being gay. The costs are not, like you put it, death and destruction for, you know, people party, they love, they kiss, who are gay here in Nairobi all the time. And so it's not the doom and gloom that the Western media want to think of it, like death on the streets. And, but for me, it was, I lost a friend. I lost a close friend. He died of AIDS. He was very young. He was 23. He had been staying in my house. And it just struck home in a certain way that insulation itself makes it impossible for you to be a citizen, an artist, in a certain way. And I wanted to know that I can live here. I already know I can, because I have really all my life in one way or another. But live here in a closer, more rural, and a slightly more accountable way. Then, of course, there was the laws going on in Nigeria and Uganda.
Just a little bit more about, you know, this idea that, as you write, you've known you were homosexual since you were 5, and yet I think you didn't say the word gay until you were 39, and that this kind of keeping this locked in yourself had to have been locking in a certain part of, as I think you just said, had to have been locking in a certain part of your artistry and your writing.
Sure. I have just been loved, right? Yeah. All my life in many ways. And I feel that my life has been both precious and useful, and I'm very happy about it. And I'm happy about the book where I hadn't come out either. But different seasons of your life give different impetus. I want not to be alone. I'm a curious person in many ways, and I want to examine in a more public way what it means to be gay. I want to write about it. I knew I wanted to write about it as early as 5 years ago. I was nervous about the language and so on and so forth.
Well, you know, it's funny because rereading your stunning book through this new prism, I see you as a child differently, as a five-year-old dressing up in your mother's clothes, you know, with your sister, yeah, or in school playing a prostitute with a heart of gold. We read the book differently now.
Yes. I do too. I mean, like, I wasn't maybe mildly conscious of all those sorts of implications then. So that's been interesting and fun.
Well, no, and it is. And it's a child, as you said, it's not a child. It's a child exploring.
Oh, quite a lot. Things certain get out of your control. And in my sense, the sense of getting out of your control now was more feeling at 40 that I come at a time that I have to be responsible to a public. That's why I came back home. To do that means being back in the 60s when, you know, there are all these things to do.
Well, as you said, the news from some countries in Africa also gave you an urgency. Nigeria signing the anti-gay bill into law, Uganda's anti-gay bill. You called the Nigerian bill Nazi-like. We're not broad-brushing the whole continent, but there are definitely two countries in which this is a huge, urgent problem.
Yeah. I always hedge my bets when I'm saying these things because you always kind of feel the surge from America with a white shining sword to come and fix it. And that's not my politics at all. We fix our own things here, please, just like you do. So I need to put that in brackets.
Well, I'm going to jump in to say you put it into a provocative article in Granta, How to Write About Africa. And that's one of the things you say, that when Westerners write about issues in Africa, it is with the triumphal, we are going to save the starving Africans or the persecuted gay Africans or, you know, pick your category.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things going on in the world right now. In Russia, there are things going on. The president of Uganda announced that he's going to play with Russia and tell America to go F themselves. And then everyone is talking about homosexuality is a Western import. So these are political things, too. And they're serious things. There are things, you know, that in nations that are growing now very fast and changing very rapidly. I am very happy that there's a constitutional petition which has a good chance of winning in Uganda, for example, and that they're building on one in Nigeria, for example, and that the movement in Uganda in particular is quite strong, the LGBT movement, right? But we are all here fighting for, like any human being, for not just dignity and not just freedom from being killed. It's to feel as a free spirit in space and time, right? To imagine your own futures. It's just the work that people do. I'm concerned about the death penalty in Texas, too, my dear. I mean, I'm concerned about somebody who may be beaten and stoned in Uganda. We all are, right? I'm concerned about the fact that women can't walk safely in the streets of Nairobi. I'm interested in the fact that they can any time of the day, night in Addis Ababa. There are people being picked up by the United States from Kenya to go to places we don't know who are Muslim, right? I'm concerned about them, right? I'm concerned, too, that these Al-Shabaab guys are in my country doing things that we don't know, right? I'm a writer and I'm a person and these things are there in front of us, right? So these are just the stuff of life.
Well, Binyavanga Wainaina, what's been the response to the Lost Chapter?
The usual homophobes we are used to make their noises but have an approach. But I haven't been threatened in any way. The positive response from all manner of Africans is huge. It just continues. It meant all kinds of conversations. So for me, it's been great. It felt that if I helped move the world around me 2 millimeters, that's a good result.
Kenyan writer and journalist Binya Vanga Wainaina, his memoir is One Day I Will Write About This Place. We'll also link you to his other writings in Granta and The Lost Chapter. Binya Vanga, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Two prep school graduates, Timothy Brooks and Neil Scott, were arrested this week and charged with running a drug ring that tried to corner the trade to prestigious high schools and colleges near Philadelphia. 8 pounds of marijuana, 23 grams of cocaine, 11 grams of ecstasy, $11,000 in cash, 2 rifles and a loaded handgun were found after a search of the young men's apartment. The county district attorney said it was an illegal business with sophisticated practices that the two young men had nicknamed the Mainline Takeover Project. Mari Schaefer from the Philadelphia Inquirer is covering the case. And Mari, the investigation has been going on for months, but how are these arrests reverberating there? And remind us, to people outside the area, what does that mean, Mainline Takeover Project?
Well, Robin, definitely this is the talk of the town right now. Haverford Township and Haverford School, where 4 of the defendants attended, it's a very affluent area. The tuition runs somewhere between $25,000 and $30,000. So I think that adds an extra element to this that, you know, I mean, there are drugs on just about every school campus. I don't think anyone would dispute that. But just having that aspect to it makes it a little more interesting for this area. The Main Line is a very affluent area. It's outside of Philadelphia, and it's you know, one of their bigger suburbs.
Yeah.
The schools that are involved are some of the top schools in the state, frankly.
Well, and tell us more about these two young men, Timothy Brooks, Neil Scott.
Tim Brooks and Neil Scott were lacrosse players. They attended Haverford and graduated from there and went on to college, although from what I understand, Neil Scott allegedly was kicked out of Connecticut College, where he attended, for selling drugs and possibly making fake IDs. Tim Brooks has left Richmond. He was recruited down there, and he left. I guess he had some injury, and he came back to do some rehab up here, is what his attorney said. And they, you know, according to their coach, they were two kids who just lost their way.
Well, there are reports that some high school administrators were upset they didn't know about the investigation until hours before authorities announced the arrests on Monday. 11 people total arrested. We've talked to parents who live in the area, at least one who says, well, "Is this as, you know, would this get as much attention if it weren't, if you didn't have the handy Mainline Takeover Project handle to hang it on?" But there are also reports that these two ringleaders strong-armed kids in school that they'd enlisted, saying things like, "You have to sell a pound of marijuana a week." Do we know how threatening they were?
They did employ some very interesting business practices, almost very traditional. They had quotas for their sub dealers, and I you know, just like with any business, if you don't make your quotas, I guess there was some pressure there. I don't know if I would use the word strong arm, but they definitely had the quotas,
yeah,
for their sub-dealers.
Well, you know, it's interesting because here we have this situation here, but of course in Colorado, young people are putting together business plans for the legal sale of marijuana. What is the sense of what's going to happen to these arrested people?
Well, their preliminary hearing is coming up within a week, I would guess. This is still illegal in Pennsylvania, and these are serious charges. I mean, Neil Scott, and you know, a loaded AR-15 assault rifle was found in his apartment. They were set, you know, his apartment was within 1,000 yards of the school itself, and they were marketing to children. Let's be honest, they were marketing to high school kids. So that's some serious charges that they're going to be facing,
yeah,
in the future here.
Mari Schaefer, reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer, following the story of the Mainline Project outside Philadelphia. Mari, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
And now to some big news in the drug industry. The Swiss drug maker Novartis is buying the British company GlaxoSmithKline's cancer drug business for as much as $16 billion. Novartis is also selling its vaccine business to Glaxo for around $7 billion. And the two companies are forming a joint venture consumer drug business. The news came yesterday, and analysts are saying it's part of a larger shakeup that is reshaping the entire industry and could have big implications for consumers. Oliver Staley is a reporter for Bloomberg News. He's with us from the Bloomberg Newsroom in London. And Oliver, why are these changes happening now?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. The first, probably the largest, is a lot of these companies are facing the expiration of drugs that have been protected by patents. Those patents are expiring, and so they're facing the loss of revenues. So they're searching for new profits. The other reason is they're facing increased pressure on prices. Insurance companies and governments, who are the largest buyers of drugs, are unwilling to keep on accepting price increases. So as the companies are getting squeezed, they're trying to find more efficient ways of making money.
And we should say, when you say that they're facing the expiration of these patents, what that means is that generics can come in and compete with essentially the same drugs.
Exactly. And so for some companies, you see a pretty dramatic drop off in the profitability of those drugs. When they had the control of the patent, they could sell a drug, for example, Lipitor, which was Pfizer's big seller, could sell for $11 billion a year, and then it falls dramatically down to something like $2 billion a year.
So why does it help a company that is facing that kind of loss in profit to go and get together with another company's cancer drug business, for example?
Well, so what they're doing is finding what they're good at and getting rid of the things they're not good at. That means they are more efficient and they get rid of sort of lower performing units. It also means that you can't be all things to all customers anymore. It used to be you could have the third, fourth, or fifth best drug in any category and still count on insurers and governments buying it. You can't get away with that anymore.
So you're saying that a company like Novartis may just be the cancer drug company?
Well, there'll be a couple of things, but they won't be. They'll have three or four specialties instead of 9 or 10 specialties. And I think that's what you're seeing across the board.
Tell us about this joint venture consumer drug business with Glaxo and Novartis. What's the idea there?
Those are consumer products like toothpaste, eye drops, Excedrin, headache pills. And those are kind of low margin, high volume businesses. So the idea is to get as big as possible. And by combining, they'll be the second largest consumer products healthcare group after Johnson & Johnson, and they'll be the largest seller of over-the-counter drugs. And so the idea is that they're combining their strengths. Both of them believe they have strong brands, and so they're holding on to them but creating a new company to profit from them.
Now, if an average American consumer is listening to this and wondering, what does this mean for me? I think of the consolidation, for example, in the airline industry. When airlines get together, prices go up. That's just what has happened over the last several years. Is that what's going to happen now with drugs?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, from the baseline, drug prices rarely go down. So I think we can assume that drugs will continue to get more expensive. But I think you're right. I mean, one of the concerns I've heard expressed about this deal is that as companies shed units that are less profitable, they won't be competing in them anymore. And less competition, as you say, usually results in higher prices. It also may mean less innovation. And drugs are basically an innovation business. And if you have less scientists working on cancer drugs or other important diseases, then we may have fewer options for solving those diseases in the future.
You're saying even if a company like Novartis buys up the cancer drug business for GlaxoSmithKline and spends billions of dollars on it, that their R&D, their innovation could go down?
Glaxo's may. Now, Glaxo says they're going to continue. They have a team and a successful team that has developed the oncology drugs that Novartis is buying. And so they say they will continue to develop those cancer drugs. But in other, there may be cases where the company simply shed those divisions, seeing them. If they're not going to be able to market them, they may not want to be developing them.
Are you expecting more big deals like this in the industry going forward?
Yeah, I think the trend certainly looks like we're going to see other companies shedding the units that aren't core to their earnings. Merck, for example, also has a consumer products division that they're trying to sell. And we've heard of there's some rumors of some fairly big mergers and acquisitions out there. And we've reported that Pfizer talked to AstraZeneca about buying the company, all of the company, which would be a huge, potentially $100 billion deal. So remains to be seen if it's going to happen, but there's a lot of talk out there. And yesterday certainly was an exciting day in the business world.
Oliver Staley, reporter with Bloomberg News in London, talking with us about some big deals in the pharmaceutical industry. Oliver, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, one birthday we want to note today, Robin. It is William Shakespeare's 450th.
Ta-da.
Is that all? You don't have any trumpets?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Well, to celebrate, I thought maybe we could read a little bit from A Midsummer Night's Dream.
With apologies to all ninth grade English classes.
I will be Puck, you be the fairy.
A tutu.
Here we go. How now, spirit, whither wander you?
Over hill, over dale, through bush, through briar, over park, over pale, through flood, through fire. I do wander everywhere, swifter than the moon's sphere, and I serve the fairy queen to dew her orbs upon the green. The cowslips tall her pensioners be, in their gold coats spots you see. Those be rubies, fairy favors, in those freckles live their savors. I must go seek some dewdrops here and hang a pearl in every cowslip's ear. Farewell, thou lob of spirits, I'll be gone. Our queen and our elves come here anon.
The king doth keep his revels here tonight. Take heed the queen come not within his sight, for Oberon is passing fell and wrath because that she as her attendant hath. A lovely boy stolen from an Indian king, she never had so sweet a changeling, and jealous Oberon would have the child knight of his train to trace the forests wild. But she perforce withholds the loved boy, crowns him with flowers, and makes him all her joy. And now they never meet in grove or green, by fountain clear or spangled starlight sheen, but they do square that all their elves for fear creep into acorn cups and hide them there.
Is this the end? Am I not a fairy anymore?
Actually, the funny thing is that Puck is actually named Robin.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so maybe we should have switched roles.
There you
Next
go.
Time.
Next time. And happy birthday, Shakespeare. Fans of social media know there's sort of a social media Darwinism. There's always a new platform for sharing, connecting with others. As AOL made way for Gmail, MySpace made way for Facebook. But what happens to the old profiles you leave behind? Taylor Quimby of Here Now contributing station NHPR decided to take a look.
MySpace. One could say it's the velvet leisure suit of social media.
Do you have a MySpace account?
MySpace, yes, actually do.
Do you use it on a regular basis?
I haven't touched it in years, to be honest.
But it's probably still there.
Yes.
It's pretty normal to look back at old outfits and wonder, ugh, what was I thinking? History hasn't been kind to hammer pants or the fanny pack. And like the leisure suit, MySpace has suffered the same sort of fate. It's become a punchline.
Do you know anybody that has a MySpace?
Yeah, my dad has a MySpace.
But lest we forget, we're not talking about a trend from 15 or 20 years ago. In fact, it wasn't until 2008 that Facebook users first outnumbered fans of MySpace. Less than 6 years ago. MySpace was the hottest social media platform since Friendster. Remember Friendster? And even today, MySpace claims to have some 36 million users. But who are they? Do you have one? Did you ever have one? And when you decided to move on, did you delete your account?
All right. See if we can find Taylor's MySpace.
That's producer Zach Nugent and my boss, Maureen McMurray.
MySpace.
So, if you haven't already guessed, there's a reason I'm the one telling the story.
Okay, here it is. Oh, my. That's Taylor. Yep. That's
oh, my God. What is going on here? Let's just... Is that Taylor?
Around 2006 and 7, I was really into MySpace. And then, like many others, I abandoned it. I didn't delete my account, I just kind of drifted away. And since nobody I knew used it anymore, I sort of thought MySpace would just drift away too. But in 2012 and 2013, MySpace redesigned the site to focus on the one demographic still using it, musicians. They ditched the classic MySpace look, and all the blog posts, messages, likes and dislikes we agonized over, it all got sent to the digital trash bin. All of it except for one thing, the photos. Which means if you haven't deleted your account, its ghost is still there. And your leftover MySpace photos are up for the whole world to see.
Taylor, did you ever have a shaved head?
Shaved head with ping pong balls as eyes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's you?
Brushing your teeth?
In the MySpace days, I looked a lot different.
And there's one of him.
As like the Joker?
Do you have blood on your face?
Frankly, I didn't use a lot of discretion when posting pictures.
Do we want to just describe this photo?
He's pantsless and he has an axe.
He's in a Speedo. He's in a straight up Speedo.
My MySpace page was an extension of my musical alter ego at the time, an experimental project I called Milky Pink.
Like this, it looks like you're part of some cult.
It was pretty weird.
I don't know if you can read the caption underneath, but it says Milky Pink, murder capital of the world.
That was, okay, so the explanation here is that was the cover art for my first album as Milky Pink.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that's you?
Yep. Now, none of this stuff is so bad it would ever get me fired, I think. But should I ever be looking for a new job, it's within the realm of possibility that an employer might see it. And the fact that it's just sitting out there for anybody with an internet connection to see makes me pretty uncomfortable. And work aside, I'm a dad now. I don't plan on hiding my past from my son, but I would like to be able to control how it's presented. So, here it is. The point of this whole story, how to delete your MySpace profile. Step 1. If you know the email and password to your old account, then congratulations. This is going to be a snap. All you have to do is log back in, go to your settings, and select Delete Account. If, like me, though, you don't have a clue what your email address was when you signed up for MySpace, or you signed up with a college email that's since been deactivated, it's a little more complicated. Before you can delete an account, you've got to prove that it's yours to delete. You need to sign the MySpace Declaration of Ownership. It's pretty easy to find once you know what you're looking for. But there is one tricky part. It requires that you attach a digital copy of a government-issued ID. Seriously. Once you've got that done, you can pretty much just fill it out and press send.
All right, I'm doing it, guys. Oh, wait. It's mad at me. What did I fill out here?
The form is going to ask you for all the information we have already established you do not have access to. So you've got to find a workaround, like I did.
Okay, maybe if I just fill out don't know for all those fields.
Yeah,
hold on.
Okay, now you can press send. And from there, you're just waiting. For me, it wasn't very long. I actually got an email from MySpace the very next day.
Already?
Yeah, I know. Let's see what it says. Thank you for filling out the deletion form. I have scheduled the profile in question for removal. So I guess that was it. Please allow up to 72 hours. Dexter.
Sincerely, Dexter.
MySpace, more efficient than we thought.
My guess, Zach, is that like 90% of the staff is dedicated to deleting people's accounts at this point.
As it turns out, deleting your profile may not be the eye-rolling ordeal you'd imagine. And depending on what you find still there, if you happen to Google yourself, it could be a tremendous relief. So if you never deleted your old account, it might be time to do a little digital housekeeping. After all, there's really no such thing as my space or your space when it comes to the internet. It's everybody's space, for better and for worse. For Here and Now, I'm Taylor Quimby.
Now I feel like I have to go and delete some accounts that I didn't even know were still there.
I'm doing it right now.
You know, we've got some news, Robin, from the world of late-night TV that may give us a little bit of a glimpse into the future of late-night TV. Stephen Colbert went on David Letterman's Late Show on CBS last night. He's, of course, going to be taking over for Letterman when he retires next year. Colbert appeared as himself, not the character he plays on The Colbert Report, and he told the story of how he got an internship at Letterman's old show back in 1986.
Here's what happened, is that in 1986, my girlfriend in college got an appointment to interview for an internship at the old show over at NBC.
May I ask what became of her?
You'll see. It's part of the story. She came here for the internship, and she was in the room getting the interview, and I'm just waiting in the hallway like a boob. And the person the next door opens up and says, are you the next guy for the thing? And I said, no, my friend's in there. And they said, well, do you want to just come talk? And I said, okay. We had a 15-minute conversation. I got the internship. She did not. Yeah, the next job I'm taking here, that pays, right?
I have nothing to do with that.
Well, Colbert also mentioned that 11 years later, in 1997, he applied to The Late Show for a job as a writer. And last night, he brought along his writing sample and read it. It was a Christmas season top 10 list.
These are the top 10 cocktails for Santa.
Top 10 cocktails from Santa. Okay.
Number 10, the Rusty Blitzen. It's 1 ounce of scotch, 1 ounce of Drambuie, twist of venison.
Twist of venison.
Number 9, Mama said nog you out. 3 fingers of eggnog, 1 finger of ether. Parumpa Pump Rum, open can of fruit cocktail, add 2 ounces of rum, enjoy responsibly. Vodka giblet, one part vodka, any part turkey organ. I don't think you would have hired me at this point.
Yeah, may surprise you to know that it took 4 months for The Late Show to get back to Colbert, by which time he had already taken a job with the show that became Strangers with Candy, that great Amy Sedaris show, mm-hmm. which I wish was still on the air, but it's not anymore. Anyway, of course, Stephen Colbert will take over for David Letterman in 2015 when he retires.
We learn a lot last night. First, if at first you don't succeed, those top 10 suggestions he had, they were terrible. And, you know, it was the real Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, we're learning what he's like when he's not in character on Comedy Central.
Well, we have to call him Colbert now.
That's a good question.
I don't know. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.